what effect miracles have upon the perfection of a person. By and large, miracles are not the proper devices for perfecting an individual. Because a miracle, no matter how powerful and amazing, just produces an effect on the emotion. And emotional changes do not bring about lasting perfection. That's a fundamental principle of yogas. You see that, for example, that's what's called like foxhole conversions, you know, when people are in desperate straits, you know, in the army, in a wartime situation, or any kind of a crisis. You know, you're on a plane that's about to crash. And then people start to pray and they make all kinds of deals. This makes a deal with God that if you only get me out of this one, then, you know, I'll be good and all that. And then they're saved. And then for the moment, the immediate response is one of tremendous gratitude to God, and a clear recognition that there is a God in the world and God did save them, and that therefore they should live their life in a certain way. Now what happens after that? That feeling usually maybe lasts for about 24 hours. But everything's possible, very rare that that will effectuate a profound change in a person's life. And I'll give you the proof. I always look for the proof. We have the proof in our own generation. Very clear, it's right out there. Yeah, without intending to demean, as I said, when I speak about the Holocaust and the Holocaust survivors, I never criticize them as individuals. I spoke in my shul recently, and I said that we have to have the greatest respect for a Holocaust survivor, in my opinion. The greatest respect. Because you see people today that go through relatively, the idea of trying to compare what the blacks have gone through, and that's not to diminish their suffering. Because we, as human beings, we should be concerned for any type of oppression, any kind of suffering. Whether we can, if in cases where we can do something about it, if it's an injustice being perpetrated, we certainly should protest if we can, not only with regard to Jews. But that's a separate point. The point that they're trying to make, to equate what blacks experienced and do experience with what the Jews went through in the Holocaust, and therefore they're trying to establish some type of bond between the Jews and the blacks for that reason, is totally absurd. There's no comparison. There's absolutely no comparison. Anyone who says that is totally ignorant or he's just trying to diminish what people are trying to do today. They're trying to diminish the terror, you know. It's just unimaginable. It goes beyond anything which anyone can imagine. There was never something like that in history. Now, if you read these stories of individuals and you speak to people that went through it, you can understand the state of their mind. In that state of mind, they achieved a appreciation of what really matters in life. And they look back on their lives and they realize that you know, all these things that people normally strive for are meaningless. If they could just have a little bit of freedom, if they could just have a little bit of food, they were living on basically starvation, and they're constantly beaten and constantly in terror. So in that framework, a person sees what really matters. If you could just have a little sunshine, have a little bit of food, and they'd live their lives totally differently. In that experience, people saw clearly that if they could survive, they would live totally differently. It's nonsensical to spend your whole life running after things in your imagination. These things aren't real values. Yeah, but if, again, without any denigration, I'm not denigrating anybody. If you do a survey of, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, how many people really change their whole value systems? I don't think it would make there'd be a significant change. That's a momentary feeling. However, what happened once they were liberated, then they experienced a tremendous feeling of joy, and they had this idea, now I know how to live life properly. But after a while, the emotion wears off, and then you go back to normal living, and all the forces of society are still there. So then you go for a job, and then it's a question of how much am I making, and then you go buy a house, and then when you're buying a house, the question is, well, I'd like something nicer. You know, all the old emotions are there. All it means is that due to the force of a certain emotion, in that framework you're suppressing other emotions. Because in that framework, the other emotions have no validity. The same thing is true when a person is facing death. So then the only thing that's of importance to him is just to be alive. So he's willing to do anything. He'll make any deal with God. But once the emotion, once the experience, the crisis passes, and he's still alive, so now he's got to keep his promise is not so simple. And now the difficult task of rear, what happened to all these emotions? Now all the old emotions are coming back in full force. So to keep the promise means a complete redirection of his energies and a complete change of the personality. That's not going to be produced by an emotion. That's not going to be produced. That's not such a simple thing. So that's why the real basis of a person's commitment to Torah cannot ever be because of the impact of a certain miraculous event. And that explains why the Jews, no matter how great the miracles that they saw, did not in any way contribute to their perfection. The purpose of the miracles was not to contribute to their perfection. The Rama makes that very clear. That the miracles were performed only because of certain necessities of the time. It was necessary to afflict the Egyptians. It was necessary to save the Jews. So therefore you had the splitting of the Red Sea. It was necessary for the Jews to have food in the desert, so you had the manna. But these miracles were not designed, their purpose was not to convince the Jews that this is the way they ought to live their lives. The only way that a person can achieve perfection is through the use of his mind, according to Judaism. It's through his understanding. He has to work on it until he has a real conviction. He sees it clearly. Clearly that this is the reality, that this is the good, and that there is really no other choice unless he just wants to give up his existence, he wants to give up his life. And as long as he does not have that conviction, and he really believes that the road of the emotions and the fantasies that everybody is pursuing in their lives, as long as he believes that that is really the good, then he's lost. And in that framework, a very powerful miracle is not going to bring about any type of a change. A momentary change, yes. It's a momentary thing. That is what the Rambam means. The Rambam says, let me just get it. The source is in Hilchos Yisrael Torah, in Perek Shmini, the 8th Perek. The Rambam says, Moshe Rabbeinu, lo haminu bo Yisrael, v'pnei ha'osos she'osa. The Jews did not believe in Moshe. Well, first of all, they didn't believe in Moshe. They never believed in Moshe. It means to say, believing in Moshe as being the instrument of God, the messenger of God. That he was the designated messenger. They did not believe that he was the designated messenger of God. Because of the signs, the wonders, the miracles that he had performed. Sha'amamin al-piya osos, for one who believes because of signs, yesh v'libo dofi. He retains doubt in his heart. which he's not saying that it's worthless, but he says it's not a complete conviction. There's room for doubt. It's not absolutely convincing. Interesting, a person must be absolutely convinced. She'efshishe yosa ha'os b'lot b'kishif. Because it's possible that the sign was performed with some type of magic, so to speak. It's always possible. There's always room for that type of doubt. So that's what he's saying. So the signs that Moshe performed were not intended to convince. Of course, we could ask the question immediately, because Moshe said to God, "V'hem lo yaminu li." They will not believe me. Lo yishma b'koli. As they'll say, when God assigned Moshe, he sent him at the burning bush to go to the Jews and to tell them that God had sent him and so forth. So Moshe's response was, they will not believe me. They will deny that God spoke to me. And then what was God's response was, he gave them signs. He gave them the three signs. The turning of the staff into a snake. The sign, he'll put his hand inside of his shirt and it would turn leprous. And then the turning of the water into blood. He gave them signs. this would seem to contradict right away what the Rambam is saying, because if it's not, how can you say that the purpose of the signs is not to create conviction when when God gave that to Moshe to prove to the Jews, to prove to the Jews that their God has spoken?
Also it says,
but what all of the signs that Moshe performed in the Midbar, Lafiat Sorech Asar, he only did them because of a necessity. Lo lahav yirai al hanavua, not to bring a proof for nevua. Hayitzarech lashkia as a mitzrim, it was necessary to drown the mitzrim. Kara es hayam, so he split the sea. Viti vehitzlila, and drowned them. Pesocho, nitzarchu lemazon, the Jews needed food. Hayir es haman, so he brought down the man, the manna. Samu, they thirsted. Bakal lehemas even, he split the rock and water came forth. Again, it was a miraculous phenomenon. Kafir ba'adas Korach, the congregation of Korach rebelled. Bolo osamaras, they were swallowed up in the ground. That was a miracle. V'chein she'ar kol osos, and the same is true with regard to the other signs. Now, with regard to the one that he mentioned, the splitting of the Yamsuf, so Maxim's question, but it says in the Torah over there that when the Jews saw the Egyptian dead on the Sfas HaYam, Vayamidu Bar Hashem, they believed in God and in His servant Moshe. So there, that's another question on what the Rambam is saying. It seems that the miracle of the splitting of the Red Sea did produce the effect of Amuna. Vayamidu, they believed. It also says, Vayamein Ha'am, we said when Moshe came back and performed the signs. And remember the Chazal which says Mikan, we see from Mr. Yisrael and Aminim him. So all this seems to go counter to what the Rambam is saying. But let's just complete this halacha. Uvameh Aminu Bo. So with what caused them to believe in him? The Ma'amad Har Sinai. With the event at Sinai. So the Rambam says that the ultimate source of our conviction has to be in the event which took place at Sinai. She'einenu ra'u v'lo zar. What's different about that? For our eyes saw, we saw with our own eyes, and not a stranger. V'yazneinu shamu v'lo acher. And our ears heard, and again, not somebody else. We ourselves saw and heard. Ha'esh, the fire, the akolos, the sounds, valapidim, and the flame. Vuhu nigash el ha'ar rafel, and Moshe approached the cloud, v'akol medaber elav, and the voice spoke to him. V'anu shomim, and we heard, Moshe, Moshe, leich emor lehem kach v'kach, Moshe, Moshe, go and say this and this to them. We heard God instructing Moshe. So we directly witnessed the fact that God instructed Moshe. V'cheinu omer, and it says, panim v'panim dibra Hashem imachem, that God spoke face to face with you. So in other words, the Jewish people witnessed a event in which, so to speak, God confronted them directly. God spoke face to face with the Jewish people. Or at least we witnessed via Moshe Rabbeinu, through Moshe Rabbeinu. The Nemar, it says, Lo asavaseinu karas ha-reshem ha-sabris ha-zos. Not with our fathers did God make this covenant, except with us directly. There was direct contact. U'minayin shemam ad ha-sinai lovado. How do I know that the event at Sinai alone, he haroya l'nevuaso shehi emes, that is the proof about nevuah that it is true, she'ein bo dofi, that it does not contain any doubt. That's your question. So he says, she'nemer, it says, hinei anochis bo elecha b'yav ha'onan. God, when he tells Moshe about the event, to prepare for the event, he says, behold, I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud, Bavur Yishmaham, so that the people will hear Badabri Imach when I speak to you. Bagam Bachoya Miliola. And also in you they'll believe. So in other words, God is saying that this shall always be the source for the knowledge that the prophecy of Moshe is true. But the people will see when I come and speak to you. Michlal, one can deduce, Shekodim Davazah, that prior to this, Lo Haminu Bo, Ne'amonos, Shiyomedes Liolom. It has a slightly different, expression. All this occurred after the basic miracles, the splitting of the Red Sea, etc., and the miracles in the wilderness. Then God said, "Behold, I'm going to come to you in a thick cloud." In other words, God describes and anticipates the event at Sinai, the purpose of which will be that in order for the people to see, and also in you will they believe. So God is defining the event at Sinai, the revelation, as being the ultimate source for our conviction. Thus you must conclude that prior to this, the Jews did not have what? Not that they didn't have any emunah. See, this seems to be a slight change. But rather, he says, they didn't have a conviction which would last eternally. It was not an eternal conviction. Ela ne'amonus, but they did have an ne'amonus. It's an interesting thing. See, the Rambam is not denying that would answer all of our questions that said that they did believe. That the Jews prior to Sinai did believe. They were believers. But there was something lacking in that belief. It wasn't sufficient to ensure that the Jews would maintain the Torah permanently. They needed something better. So therefore what we have to do is to define the difference between the miracles that occurred prior to Sinai and the event at Sinai itself, which is also a miracle. Again, it seems, well, if it's not a miracle, then what is it? But there's something unique in Sinai which does not exist in the other miracles. That's the question. See, that's like this. Why, you see that there was a certain amount of conviction. The Jews, it was rational, bothered to listen to Moshe on the basis of the miracle. Right? Let's try to understand why. If we can understand the fact that Moshe was able to perform miracles, so to speak, right? The rational response was to believe, therefore to believe that what he's saying is true. Let's try and understand why that is so. If we understand the positive side, then perhaps we can also see the negative side. Well, why is that so? In other words, so Moshe comes to you and he tells you something. Like he tells you that God has remembered your suffering and God's been this such and such for you and so on. And therefore you should... Alright, it's one thing to tell you this, but he's saying, therefore you should stand behind me, we're going to go to power now, we're going to demand our freedom. And don't be afraid, because God is on your side. So you'll say, how do I know God's on my side? So he'll take the staff and throw it into on the floor, it becomes a snake. So I'll say, why does that mean? How did that end? What does that prove? So fine. Now I see that a staff, something happens here. So why? What does one thing have to do with the other?
Because it's a
vision. We have to understand the connection, what it is about a miracle in the first place that produces that result. And later on, when they went to Paro, that was the methodology that they used. Now, true, Paro hardened his heart. And even there we have to see, like, what was he doing when he was hardening his heart? Was he just being obstinate? Or even in his obstinacy, but he had to convince himself. He had to have some counter-argument. There had to be some rationalization, or else you could say the man was just crazy. The man was just crazy. There was no way that he could not, in any rational way, avoid this. Or no. True, he was being stubborn, but when he was stubborn, he was utilizing a stubborn way of thinking. But there had to be some way of thinking to oppose what was going on. So let's explain how this serves as a proof. It says the people believed, so the people were convinced that the fact that you could take a snake and throw a staff and throw it on the floor and it becomes a snake, therefore whatever you're saying must be true. Why? What does one thing have to do with the other? The basic premise of all of this is that which Moshe is going to do is something which lies outside of the framework of nature. It's outside of the framework of the laws of nature. And therefore, our basic assumption is that no human being has the power to do anything which is supernatural. That man, by definition, does not have supernatural power. Of course, I know this is it's a very hard thing for people to accept, because people have a very powerful emotional desire to attribute supernatural powers to people. But any sane person, any rational person, must come to the conclusion that man cannot be in possession of supernatural powers. Why? Because man himself is natural. He exists only because he's a part of the natural order. So you wouldn't say you would not say that an animal has the capacity to bring about changes in the natural order. It itself is determined by the natural order. So any being which is determined by the natural order, which is a result of the natural order, right? His powers are limited, cannot have control over the natural order. The only way that you can effectuate a change over the natural order is if there be a being, right, who is beyond. He's the one who is responsible for establishing the order itself. So the one who is responsible for establishing the order itself has control over the system. He can make changes as he sees fit. But that's because he's not part of the system. He exists independent of the system. But if you're a part of the system, then it's impossible for you to effectuate any changes in the system. You can only operate within the laws of the system. So therefore, Moshe is going to do something which is outside the laws of the system. So therefore, it cannot be Moshe that's doing it. If you believe that, then believe in Moshe, then you're not going to believe in God. It's going to take you away from God. But it wasn't intended. The Jews didn't believe in Moshe. That Moshe is the supreme being. Now, if you accept that premise, then what's causing this to happen? Oh, so then it must be that there's a being outside the God. That's what we call God. There's a being that exists beyond the framework of the system of the universe, who is responsible for he has control over all the elements which establish the world as it is, and that being can produce the changes. Of course, the question is, so fine, so now we know that. Why should I believe that you're the... right? What's the connecting link? Why should I believe that God spoke to you? You still have that question. Now, the answer is, since this is not being done by you, right? You cannot produce this event. And this event can only be produced by that being. How do you know the exact moment at which it's going to take place? That's something which, again, we have no way of knowing the plans of that being, unless you posit that there is a way in which that being does communicate with man, and that's what we call prophecy. So the entire purpose of when we say that he performed this miracle, he performed that, you got to be very, very careful. Moshe never performed a miracle. It means that the miracles which God brought about were performed via the intermediacy, or whatever you want to call it. Not, even that is not a good word.
Instrument.
Yeah.
Arrangement of Moshe.
Right, exactly. Moshe was involved in them to a certain extent, the presentation. But he had no power. He didn't contribute in any way. He did not contribute in any way. It is the same idea we have by Birkas Kohanim. It's not the Kohanim that confer the blessing on the people. It's God, but God utilizes them. When they do this mitzvah, then God blesses the nation. But they themselves they have nothing to contribute in terms of the blessing, other than performing the mitzvah. It's a similar idea. So therefore, the proof that God spoke to you is in, because the question arises, we have something which is non-predictable by nature to the human. Since it's something which is not a result of nature, it's not predictable. There's no way a scientist could predict it, because it is not within the framework of nature, and scientists are limited to nature. Therefore, it's the result of a being who is beyond nature. And the question is, how could you possibly know? Because all the only things you can know are those things from nature. So the fact that I know the exact moment that it's going to take place can only leads to one logical conclusion. That being who is responsible is in communication with me. Hence, I'm a prophet. That's what it was intended to prove.
But Einstein in the eclipse, it would never occur to Einstein to maintain the claim that he has communication with the divine being, because
the phenomenon he was involved in was purely of a scientific character, which he had calculations and so on and so forth, but all the other scientists were privy to the same information. So that was a scientific issue. It was clear to anybody in the field that the phenomenon he was talking about was something which was within the framework of nature. Whether it would happen or whether it would happen depended upon his interpretations. You see?
Yeah, but we're talking about...
So therefore there's no way that he could have utilized that to make any type of... Even if he was so inclined, he could not have done so because all the scientists would say, we know exactly what he's doing. In the same way today, that the illusionists... You have illusionists. You have master magicians. But to us, you know, to the untutored eye, it appears as though they're really involved in something miraculous, but to someone like Ben Cohen, he knows quite clearly that it's a trick. It's a trick, and once you study, you understand that nothing happens. It's all causality. That nothing happens without cause. Except that they're very capable of manipulating the eyes. Now, let me just make one point. I'll go into that issue at a separate time. That's a good question. I raised that question a few months ago, that the first few, especially the first one, it would seem that Parra was able to duplicate. Now, if Parra was able to duplicate, so then by definition it's not a miracle. A miracle has to be something which is outside the framework of nature, meaning to say that it cannot be produced by a human being. Now, if Parra could do the same thing, so why, so it's not a miracle? The answer is, as C.D. mentioned, if you study it very carefully, the Torah points out that there was a difference, very specific, a significant difference in the nature of the two. They did it, it says, belateyam, with their magic, with their sorcery. And it doesn't say that by Moshe. Also it says that the staff of Moshe swallowed all the other snakes. So it means to say that they were able to do something by magic. Now, you know when something is being done by magic. You know it's magic, even no matter how astounding it appears, but you know it's magic for one simple reason. Because the magician is in control. And he keeps you at a distance, and it's done with all these controls, correct? If Ben were permitted to come forward and examine every step of the way and open up to things, there'd be no magic. You follow? That's what it says. They did it with magic. They didn't allow anybody to come close. They did it in such a way that the audience would be astounded. Moshe's was not done with magic. And it's not a grander scale. Had they been open and honest, they would have continued. They said, let's not disband so quickly. Assuming that it wasn't Paro, assuming it was an independent board of people who were searching for the truth, and you had Moshe's miracle, and you had the magicians, they would have launched a further investigation. They would have come to the conclusion that this is real, and this is just magic. The reason why Paro didn't do so is because he was just looking for an opportunity of denial. See, so when a person is searching for denial, he has to base it upon something. So once the magicians were able to approximate, that was sufficient. So you have a better... He wasn't searching for the truth. So yours is a little bit different. Your snake is a better snake, but whatever, it's all the same. See, God deliberately wanted Moshe to perform something which would be subject, in Paro's mind, to that type of thing, because God wanted him to come to a logical recognition. As a result of logic, why didn't God give him something which was totally overwhelming, which the magicians could not do at all? God certainly could have given, because that wasn't God's objective. Then of course they would have accepted Moshe, but they would have done so because they would have been totally overwhelmed. It wouldn't have been an intellectual recognition. It wouldn't have involved any battle. Any struggling for the truth. The way God set it up was sufficient for an intelligent person, but sufficient room for someone who is going to be stubborn. Because God wants you to arrive at the correct idea through your free choice, not through overwhelming you. So that's why it was the most perfectly designed demonstration. However, What I said, the Rambam says like this. The Rambam says that all of these miracles do not produce a perfect conviction, because they leave room for a certain amount of doubt. I think what he means is like this. Because, again, you don't have, you're making an assumption. You're making an assumption. That this, it involves certain assumptions. That this, what occurred just now, it really cannot occur. It's really supernatural, so to speak. It's not part of nature. But then there's always the possibility that I don't know enough about nature. That's what the Egyptians always receded into that idea. That's what they said. Well, every 50 years or so, you'll have this phenomenon of the frog. They always sought some type of rationalization. Because maybe, on the other hand, it appears to be totally astounding, but maybe there's something more to it than that. It is making a deduction. You're assuming that what you're seeing over here is attributable to the Creator, and that the prediction of Moshe is an indication that he's received that. These are assumptions, which are logical assumptions to make. They are the most logical assumptions to make. That's why it says by Aminu that the Jews believe that, given the most rational conclusion, if you're in that situation, is to follow Moshe. That's the most rational conclusion. However, in terms of being absolute, you're still with certain doubt. Because it's not a direct thing. In other words, it's like circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence which leads to a certain, that's the best explanation we have of is there a being out there? A being of supreme wisdom who does communicate with man? Well, this is a manifestation. The manifestation is that we see a certain thing that can't fit into our understanding of nature. Well, but then on the other hand, there's another part that's saying, but how much do we really understand about nature altogether? So that's the way it appears to us. And the fact that Moshe does know that this is going to occur, and therefore we assume that he's in communication with God, that's the most plausible explanation that we have. So what God gave to the Jews prior to Sinai were events, the most plausible explanation of which would be that you should go along with Moshe. You're in that situation, go along with Moshe. But in terms of personal perfection, of being something which is absolute, which doesn't leave any room for doubt, that was lacking. Until, because it's all an assumption that it is circumstantial, that if this is happening, I must presuppose that those are all presuppositions. But there wasn't any direct communication with that source. Sinai was direct communication with the source. Here you're having a direct encounter. That source is speaking to you from the heaven in an unmistakable way. That can't be. There's got to be... That's it. Now it's not a question anymore, because I see a certain thing occurring in nature over here. I'm making an assumption that it's coming from there. Here I'm in direct communication with the source. That's the difference. That it's an open manifestation. An open manifestation of the Creator to the greatest extent that man can possibly have. I mean, you can't see the Creator. The Creator is not physical. So therefore, there are two avenues. One avenue is the knowledge of the Creator is through the study of the Chachmas Hashem. Any person that studies the world, the universe, and sees the tremendous Chachma is aware that there must be a source beyond. That is true. But in terms, but that's one thing. That wasn't the purpose of Sinai. The purpose of Sinai, of course, it demonstrates the existence of a Creator. But more than that, its purpose was to establish the veracity of Torah and Nevuas Moshe. Because Moshe was designated as the proper instrument of God. That they saw directly with their own eyes. They saw that being expressing, well, Dar of course is not talking, but the voice is one which can only be attributed to a heavenly source. Directly appointing Moshe Rabbeinu, he's the one. So therefore, that's why the Rambam says in the next halacha that if any prophet after Moshe, who no matter what miracles he performed, If his objective is to refute the teachings of Moshe, then he's a false prophet. Because he is operating with miracles. And miracles are a lower level. Miracles cannot contradict that which you yourself have seen with your own eyes. You see? For example, a perfect illustration of this would be if you did not witness an event. If you did not witness an event. So you hear an account that somebody killed so-and-so. So you're not sure to believe whether it's true, whether it's not true. So a lot will depend upon the veracity of the one who's telling it to you. You'll interrogate and so forth. Then you have two different versions. You have two different versions. Now, if one of the parties is able to perform all kinds of miraculous events and so forth, then you'll give more credence to his version. Right? You'll give more credence to his version. But let's say you yourself were there. Let's say you yourself were there and you saw the entire thing. And then you come upon this individual who's giving a false version. And he's convincing all these people because he's performing all these miracles. He's turning, he's turning rocks into water and so forth. And the people are totally impressed. They've got to believe what he says. So they, in their context, they have nothing better to go by. So they might believe him. This person is a prophet, they'll say. What he says, but you who were there, would you believe? Now, no matter whatever miracle this person could do, whatever he could do, the most miraculous thing, he would cause fish to come out of the water and fly around. Right? And then come into the room and write Einstein's theory of relativity on the board and provide an explanation. He'd do all these things. And say that that event did not occur. That person did not do such and such, but you were there when you saw it. Would you believe him? No. That is the reason why the Rambam says that any prophet that comes subsequently to Moshe Rabbeinu, if his prophecy is to contradict anything in the Torah, then automatically he must be false. And we don't compare. We're not going to say, well, let's take a look at his miracles and let's take a look at Moshe's miracles. That's the answer to the question. Because if we believe Moshe because of miracles, if the reason why we believe Moshe is because of miracles, so then you have a conflict. Then why? How can the Torah command us? How can the Torah command us not to believe in a false prophet? But if he performs miracles, so then why is he a false prophet? Do we believe Moshe because of Moshe's miracles? That makes him a prophet. Now the other guy is also doing miracles. How do I know it's true? The answer is because we don't believe in Moshe because of miracles. We believe in Moshe because we saw God speaking with Moshe face to face, so to speak. And that is to say that we know through direct first-hand knowledge that the Torah is true and Torah's Moshe is true. And therefore, whatever another person does, and the Rambam leaves open the possibility. No matter what he does, the miracles of the other individual could be greater than the miracles of Moshe. But if he contradicts Moshe, he's false, because no miracle will cause you to believe in something which goes contrary to what you have seen with your own eyes. And that's an extremely important idea. That the yisod of our emunah is conviction in the event of Sinai, that event which is something which can be demonstrated. I haven't gone into the proofs of how we know the actual event took place, but that's obligatory upon us to know. According to the Ramban, it is a mitzvah for every person to know, to understand the basis why it is that we not believe, with emotional faith, but rather why we have proof, why we have knowledge, the source for our conviction that the event which the Torah describes of Torah Mi-Sinai actually occurred, historical proof. And that is the only conviction upon which your emunah should rest. If you have conviction as far as that's concerned, then it's unnecessary to go searching for boats, which are the ark or not the ark. If your motivation in that search would stem from the fact that you need that push, then you don't have a proper conviction. If you want, as I said, from another standpoint, whether there's any benefit in terms of winning people over, that's something else. They have these other, by the way, they have today, Eishei Torah does this, they go around with these, have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
They give these demonstrations. Have you attended any of their seminars?
Yeah.
They're very, from what I've never attended, I heard they're very convincing. True?
Yeah.
Their method is to show that the Torah was written in such a way that it contains, so to speak, hidden codes. And if you, they've deciphered some of them, and therefore the Torah contains within it knowledge, information, which the individuals were supposedly of the time, if you attribute, in other words, you mean to say that if you assume it was written by individuals, it was impossible for them to have knowledge of the time, of what would occur in the future, and by deciphering the codes, you will see that references to the future are unmistakable. And these codes are not arbitrary, because according to the experts and you know, mathematics and statistics and computers, they say that it's totally impossible for these types of things to occur.
Randomly.
So therefore, once you establish that it's not random, and you establish that there's a definite plan, then you're making an impact upon people in terms of bringing them closer to the Torah. Now, let me just finish with that. That is really not. Obviously, the utilization of these codes were not intended by God to be the basis of conviction, because they've only been discovered recently. Again, my sense would be that in and of itself, these codes I don't think are sufficient. I'm not against them, because it creates a certain interest in people's minds, and it should lead to further study. But the ultimate proof, if you just leave a person with the codes, I don't think he's going to really change his way of life. It's interesting. He'll walk away saying, yeah, see, it's just like the miracles. Yesh acharei hirur. It's interesting, it's cute, but it doesn't convince me. I don't think a person will be that amazed. Because people know, they've heard, people believe that there are like Nostradamus, they hear about things, that they made predictions and so forth. So the fact that there are certain predictions or whatever, you know, that might impress people, but it's not enough to get a person to really change his way of life. So I'm not against these demonstrations, provided that they have the proper follow-up. And with these type of codes in Eishei Torah that they use, which are truly amazing, let's assume that all of the scientists will agree that it's almost impossible to say it's random. That's absurd. And therefore there's tremendous credence. I think they're good for those people that need it. In other words, we shouldn't abandon our search for the real conviction. The real conviction must be, you know, Anochi Baruch Abiyah Ha'anah, the event of Torah Misinai. That you must have. You can't use that if this is a substitute. I think that this could be used for the type of people that need it. I'm afraid that what it does is it makes a very powerful emotional impression on the audience. They'll walk away with a sense of being astounded. And if that's all it is, a few days later, they're just going to be right back where they were. I believe that the leaders of the movement themselves are aware, because I know they were in contact with some of our people, that what they said was that they're very good at evoking the interest level of people to get them involved for the time being, but they don't have a follow-through. You can't leave people, you know, you can't just present them with that and okay, go home now and live a Torah life. It's not going to be. It's got to be followed up with teaching so that if a person doesn't see firsthand, even Torah Misinai proof is only intended as a beginning. That should lead you into a real pursuit of Torah knowledge. If it doesn't lead to a firsthand involvement in studying of Torah and seeing the Chachmas of Torah, I don't think you're going to change your life. You just might be a little bit more religious, you know, perhaps more guilty about violating, a little bit worried that maybe it's that type of thing. But all of these methods are intended as the first step. But I say, but as a first step, the codes will never substitute for Torah Misinai, because again, the codes partake of that other element of it still is doki. There's still some yesh acharei here. There's always that possibility. You know what I mean? That these, that there is a random phenomenon over there. But it is random. But it is, you know, like there is a possibility that maybe, you know, it's not that of absolute. It's not absolute. The only thing that's absolute is Torah Sinai. But the Rambam, somebody asked, what if a prophet would come and would produce that heavenly voice which we've been talking about? Then it's not a miracle. A miracle means some type of change. You're being affected by this, by a change in the normal operation of nature. That's a miracle. But other than that, the conclusions that you draw from it are your own conclusions. You're assuming. You're making certain assumptions that this can only be because of such and such and such. That's why the Rambam says, since it has these conclusions, there's always that room for doping. Because it is not direct. You're not actually witnessing the source directly, or as close as we can come to it. But once you witness the source directly, that's something else. That's what the Rambam says. Now, therefore, you're not going to have a case where another prophet's going to come and produce. There's not going to be another Sinai. There's not going to be another revelation. That's the revelation. That's part of Aramona, that there is not going to be, that revelation itself contains within it the idea that there won't be another revelation. That's it. That's the revelation that God has determined for mankind. That's it. By definition, that's it. There's no more revelations. You will have prophets, however. But the reason why we believe a prophet is only because that is part of the revelation. The revelation says God has a certain come. Exactly. That there's a certain thing called prophecy. And it's established by Allah. And even there the Rambam says, to the Rambam's position, that that individual who fulfills the test of prophecy, we have to follow what he says, and it's possible that he's not a prophet. It's possible that God didn't communicate with him. That's what the Rambam said. The reason why we follow him is because it is a mitzvah of the Torah to follow someone who has a chalal shame of being a prophet, just like you have to postulate on the basis of Edom. And does it mean that Edom are always speaking the truth? No, the reason why we believe Edom is not because we say all prophets that come after Moshe Rabbeinu, the only reason why we believe them is because that is part of Torah. And therefore, it's going to be within a limited frame. They can't come to, if they come to be Mecharish thus, to teach us a new law, false prophet. It's a very limited area, only for the needs of the moment, or to be mochiach diam, to give them tochacha. Their only role is to preserve the nation in terms of its existence, in terms of maintaining the system as a warning. It's part of God's chesed that they, even though we stray from the Torah, God sends prophets to us to help us out with particular advice and so forth. But it can't be to produce anything new.
Interesting is, we mentioned yesterday that the Gemara at the end of the Perek Elo Ovin in Pesachah, it's a Gemara that says that. The Gemara says that in this world we have two blessings. One for good tidings, which is Atov HaMetiv, who is good and does good, and one for bad tidings, for example death, we say Dynamis. But in the world to come, then there'll only be one blessing, which will be Hatov HaMetiv. That's an interesting Gemara to analyze in so much. Because, you know, what's going to change in the world to come? Mamonasha, anybody want to look at it? If there's such a thing as bad tidings, then nevertheless we have to make a bracha, and the bracha is dynamis, so that's the truth. So we should say dynamis then. If on the other hand, the truth is that we should say Hatov HaMetiv, that's the truth, so then we should restart it now. How do we analyze this Gemara? It seems to be a contradiction. Just parenthetically, according to the Rambam, he's only dealing with two different realms of existence. We only are familiar with two realms of existence. There is the physical realm, this earth, which has its purpose, and that is the purpose of the perfection of the human soul. It can only be attained in this world, where it is related to the body and the instinctual, and has to cope with all of the situations that exist for man to cope with in this world. That's the arena of human perfection, and the ultimate objective is the existence of the soul unrelated to the body in its most perfect state, and that's what's known as Olam Haba, the world to come, and that is not a physical existence, it is the ultimate good and eternal existence. That's it. You only have those two frameworks. That's how he approaches the area. So therefore, every other category that we're dealing with has to fit into one of the two. Now, for example, Yemos HaMashiach. Yemos HaMashiach is not a phenomenon of the world to come. It has nothing to do with the ultimate reward. That's a key element in the Rambam's approach. Other thinkers associated Yemos HaMashiach with the ultimate reward. The Rambam refused to make that connection. And he said that Yemos HaMashiach has nothing to do with the ultimate reward. That's simply a factor of God's relationship to man in this world. It is a historical phenomenon. It's something which is going to occur in the terms of existence that pertain in this world. At a certain point in time, certain changes will occur in the social order. And they will be of a positive nature and will bring about the perfection of the system which God intended for man in this world. But that's basically this world. And this world, the way God created the world, that's the way it's going to be, because God created it in the most perfect way. And it makes sense that it should stay this way. It's God's will. The laws of nature, everything that we encounter because it was God's will to set it up this way. It's not temporary. It's not going to change. Olam Kimin Hago Noe. The only changes that will occur will be changes in terms of the values of the world and in terms of the relationship of the Jewish people to the rest of the world. The Jewish people will be permitted to fulfill their mission undisturbed, and so on and so forth. But that all has to do with this world. But there will be death, as we said. Olam Kimin Hago Noe. The people will live. The life will be a better life. You can assume that health will improve, longevity will improve, but that's it. Longevity is longevity. It's not. There's no objective for man to live forever. It's the fantasy of immortality, which is absurd. The objective is for man to obtain the best possible existence in this world in order that he can perfect himself and merit the real good, which is eternal, which is the life of the world to come. So there will be death. Now, there will be death, I assume there will be funerals and funeral services. So instead of the blessing of Diana Emes, they will recite HaTov HaMeitiv. And that's the basis of the question. Why will there be a change? Why will death suddenly be good then? If you're going to tell me it's because then we will recognize that death is not death, and that the person is moving on to a better state of existence, for which we are thankful, well, we recognize that now. Yet now we limit ourselves to a begrudging type of recognition of dying hymnus. That's a good point that Maxime raises. In the days of Mashiach, we're assuming that everybody will be perfected, and everybody will merit all our book. I don't know, according to the Rambam's presentation, whether it's necessary to assume that, because man will still have free will. It is true that the probabilities will be much greater, because the whole value system of mankind will be directed towards the good. So you don't realize the impact. The way you're living your life, very few people realize the extent to which their behavior is dictated by external circumstances. Very few people realize it. The people are always proud of saying that they're not influenced by public opinion, or they're independent, they're not conformist. But if anyone takes a look at their life, they'll see that everything in their life is basically conformist. They haven't really given much thought. They mean that they're not conformist with regard to certain particulars. They like to do things slightly differently. But in reality, it has a tremendous effect upon them. So if the entire structure of the world and all the value systems are geared towards the value of Torah, this will have a very significant impact. But it doesn't guarantee that everybody will be a tzaddik. There'll be no Rishayim in the time of Mashiach, according to the Rambam. I don't see why you have to assume that. Basically, today we have tzaddikim and rishayim. Of course, the ratio, as you know, without having to do any studies, any statistical surveys, I don't think you need that to know that the ratio is balanced very heavily on the side of the evildoers relative to the righteous. The righteous are few and far between. And in the Yemos Mashiach it will be different. The balance will be on the other side. Okay, well, what's the answer? We haven't heard an answer to the question. Bruce wants to say that the emotional state of the people is such that they would simply reject this notion. And since they would reject it, they wouldn't say it. It's like a bracha v'atal. They couldn't see it. They can't see it. That's a good answer. I mentioned that there are contradictory references with regard to Yetzias Mitzrayim, Geula. On the one hand, there are many statements that indicate that it was a permanent, that God redeemed us, put us in a permanent state of freedom. On the other hand, there are indications that we are still in a state of slavery. For example, you find even in the Tfilos, aside from statements in the Haggadah, because the Haggadah says, for example, Shata Abda, Hashan Abav Nechorin, indicating that we're Avadim, we're still Avadim. Right? On the other hand, in the very same Haggadah, we say, Lo Asam Asayin Abavad Gal, that God did not just redeem our fathers, but He redeemed us as well. So we are also redeemed. And we should view it as though we left Mitzrayim. But in the tefillah itself, for example, in Marid, in the Emes Vemuna, it says, "Hamakbi Abrosto Kol B'chor in Mitzrayim, who smote in his anger all the firstborn of Egypt, Vayotzei Esamo Yisrael, and took out his nation Israel, Mitocham, from amidst them, L'cheiros Olam, to eternal cheiros." So that indicates that we're in a state of cheiros right now. However, if you go into Shemona Esrei, one of the brachas you say is what? Tekav v'shelfo gadol v'cheiros seinu. We're praying to God for Mashiach, basically, to cause the blasting of the great shofar to indicate our freedom. So that means that we're right now we're not in a state of cheiros. Can't take your rhythm. So the answer is that there's two different levels. In the sense that we were removed from the Mitzrayim and we were given the Torah. So that's the Megara says that ain cheres el Torah, that freedom is nothing except for Torah, because it says choros al luchos, that the words b'choros were engraved, and the word choros also contains the the root of the word cheres. Don't read choros, read cheres. Cheres is freedom. Freedom is in the tablets, which means to say that the true freedom for man can only come about through understanding, through knowledge. And that's the way he can be free from his instinctual enslavement. Now, we have the Torah, but we're still not totally free, because on one level we're free, and that is the level of recognition of certain ideas. But on another level, we're still enslaved because of the phenomenon which is known as the Erlas Halev, the foreskin of the heart, which means that the personality has not been changed, has not been transformed. That we're really in a state of conflict. We're really living in a state of conflict. And that is that our minds direct us. We have no choice, in a sense. The Jews at Har Sinai, in a sense, had no choice. And that's the meaning of the Medrash, which says that in the end, the mountain, God caused the mountain to turn over them like a dome and said, if you accept the Torah, fine. If not, this will be your grave. You'll be destroyed here. Which is not to be taken literally, because if you read the Pesukim indicate that it was voluntary acceptance. Kol Asher Dibar Hashem Na'aseh V'Nishma. Everything the Jews accepted voluntarily. Now, where are Chazal coming from with this idea that they were coerced? So you have to understand the Chazal in a more subtle form. Coerced in the sense that they really had no choice. What choice do you have? When they saw all of the events that had occurred, they understood the entire history, the reasons for their existence that God had related to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And they had a destiny which was directed by God, and the master of the universe had revealed this tremendous, awesome power at the Red Sea. I mean, the entire thing was to bring them to this mountain and give them this way of life. So you have to be insane to say no. Well, what are you going to say? What choice do you have? Of course, you have. Practically speaking, they had a choice. They had the option to be insane. But they were on a higher level than that. They were on a high enough plane to recognize that I have no choice. But it's like a person who finds himself in a very tough physical situation, bogged down with an illness, and the doctors say you have no choice except to go through this very painful procedure. Or you'll take your chances with the cancer and see where it leads you. So what are you going to do? You have no choice. Assuming, but you do have a choice. You can say, I don't care, I'll just be crazy. Practically speaking, you have a choice. It's your decision to make. But from a different standpoint, what choice do you really have? Let's put a personal say, what choice do I have? I didn't like it. Now, analogous to that would be the explanation of that chazal. It means that the Jews went along with it, voluntarily, but it wasn't motivated by the underlying pull of the personality. The underlying pull of the personality was going in a different direction. They had to overcome that. They couldn't go along with that because they saw certain truths that were just too powerful to ignore. That's kafale hardidus. But that's not a perfect state. In that sense, you see, we're not in a state of chesed. To the extent that we are still affected by those drives, by those emotions that run counter to the true good of Torah, to that extent we're in a state of slavery. We're enslaved by those emotions. Of course, we're in a higher plane because we observe the Torah and we pull ourselves up to a higher level. But it's not the ultimate cheres. The ultimate cheres is umaltem es erlas lavochem, and when God will circumcise the foreskin of the heart, that there'll be a complete transformation in the personality, and that all of the emotional energy will be in line with the true good. That's the real freedom. And the person will experience real freedom. So, in the sense of living a life which is based upon the principles of freedom, that we had as soon as we got Torah. But in the sense of the perfection of the personality and experiencing that state of freedom, that will only come about when there's a real transformation. Then we'll be in a state of harmony. All of his emotional energy will be fully in line with the true good. That's the perfected personality. And that will come about in Yemos HaMashiach. Now, I think on the basis of that, we can answer the question. Because if you ask, from the standpoint of truth, which bracha is most appropriate at the time of death, so the answer is, Hatzalah Ma'amater. It's an occasion to express your awe at the greatness of God, that God enables this being to exist. If you make that blessing at the time of birth, if it's a great thing, that God grants existence to us and gives us this opportunity to obtain something which no other being has, that is to say, a relationship to the Creator. And that's the whole purpose of existence. And we make that blessing even at the time of birth, so how much more so at the time of death? Especially in light of the fact that you know that this is not even the end. That this is first, in a sense, the beginning. The real good is going to come now. So of course, Hatovah Meitiv, this is the time to really marvel at the greatness of God with regard to how he relates to man. That's the appropriate blessing. But the reason why we cannot say it right now is what Bruce said, because no person views it that way, because our emotions run counter to that idea. Since we're not emotionally perfected, we have this tremendous negative attitude, this fear of death. And we view death on the emotional plane, that's not the conviction which motivates a person. He still views death as being the worst thing, as being the ultimate evil. We haven't cured ourselves from that. Since that is the case, nobody is in a position to really feel that way. So, therefore, in order for him to enunciate that, would constitute sheker, would be falsehood. And he just doesn't believe it. And the Torah does not permit that. That would be destructive. That would be harmful for a person. Even though what he's uttering is a truth, but in his framework it's not a truth, so then it's falsehood. So that's why, but they demanded that a person should recognize that what is happening is not evil. That's why they demanded. And that's what the blessing is, Dayan Ha'emes, the true judge. That at least we demand that you recognize that this is not evil. And that what is happening over here is the result of a whole system which has been set up by the true judge. that the person's willing to concede. But to go beyond that, and you tell me that I have to recite the same blessing that I recite when I rejoice on a happy occasion, that the person wouldn't accept. And therefore, to utter that bracha would be an act of falsehood. However, in Yom Haba, in the new state, when a person is in a new state, a state where you can relate to truth. See, you have to, what you see from this is, we're in an inferior state. We can't tolerate certain truths. We cannot tolerate certain truths because of the power of the emotions. And that's why some of the greatest thinkers, philosophers, Jewish, even non-Jewish, but we're concerned primarily with Jewish, people like the Rambam, anyone that caused any type of irritation in the emotional life, the religious emotions of people, was tremendously condemned. Now, people have a very weak tolerance for real truth. And you see that in every time and every place. Once you begin, people are living their lives in accordance with certain fantasies, myths, which they have not thought through. You can see in your own family lives, you know, basically, I mean, the average individual has, you know, certain guiding principles which he's never thought about, which he's just absorbed, and what the good consists of, and so on and so forth. And why he does this, and what you do that, and what's the good in life, and how a person should live his life, and so on and so forth. Things they haven't thought of at all. Now, once you come along and you begin to question that, where we can show with logic, you can show that all the foundations of all their beliefs about things have absolutely no basis whatsoever, so then they're going to react with tremendous anger. That's why the truly great thinkers of the world, and those who were not just great in the sense of discovering a new medicine, because that doesn't challenge any person's beliefs, that's fine. But those who came along with new truths that really shook up the assumed truths by which people were living their lives, they were all in danger of being killed. Avraham Avinu. I mean, that was the greatest discovery, which was the most irritating discovery. The idea that all of the religions that people clung to were totally false and were useless, and instead that people should relate to the creator of the universe in an entirely different way, which did not satisfy their religious emotions at all. So once he began, he was able to prove it, and once he made some headway and he began to establish these principles, then the entire society turned against him, and he managed to escape by miraculous means. And that's the case of every great thinker. Even amongst the Gentiles, you see, by Socrates, he challenged the myths. Once a person challenges the myths of the society he lives in, he's going to be in trouble. Now, and the society of today is no different than the society of Avraham Avinu, basically. It's pretty much the same. And don't think necessarily that the Jewish society is on a high level, of course, because we have Torah. But in terms of suffering from this disease, and that is to say, unexamined existence, that they live their lives by certain myths, and even their religious beliefs are unexamined, unenlightened, and they're basically designed to cater to very primitive emotional needs. So in that same framework, once you begin to discuss the true ideas of Torah with them, and you point out that their notions are really totally imaginary, so you're going to irritate them. Truth is very irritating. And most people have a limited capacity for real truth. They don't want... The real life of the Torah observant Jew is a life of a search for truth. For the truth. That's what it says in Tehillim. Hashem Shemayim Hishkif al Bnei Adam, that God from heaven looked down on the Son of Man, mankind, Lirot, Hayesh, Maskil, Doresh, Eselokim. To see if there was... It's an amazing thing. What was God looking for? We have people that are religious and observant and so forth. And that's not what God was looking for. Is there a Maskil? Maskil means someone with a rational individual. Doresh is to search for God. How many people do you know are really searching for God? Very few people are engaged in the search for God. Even religious people, they found it. They've lost their search for it. They're very, very complacent. Now, That's what you have to realize. The capacity for people to get beyond the very comfortable myths by which they live their lives. And even if they be religious, and even if they're Jewish and they're related, somehow or other they try and tie it in with certain statements of Chazal which they've distorted to please their own emotions. The capacity to get out of that and to really deal in the world of truth is extremely limited. And therefore you have to take that into consideration when you're dealing with people. You can't just go around breaking people's myths, breaking their myths. You can't do it. You've got to know what you're doing. Because it's better, you can't tamper with the way people are living their lives. That's not a wise thing to do. Nor is it a helpful thing to do. Slowly but surely there are ways in which you can elevate people to a higher level of understanding. And that is not to say, by the way, I don't mean I'm not trying to say that we are the ones who do have the truth and the rest of us don't. That's absurd. We too have to we have the same problem. Because maybe we've gone a few steps ahead, but each one of us also has the same limitation. You know, we have to be in the same battle. The same battle to be Dorei Chesed Elokim in every area. You'll find areas where you'll have the exact same conflict. Where ideas, you will have tremendous resistance to ideas because they run counter to your emotions. I mean, I don't mean when I present this to give anyone a sense of superiority. They're absolutely false. If a person has elevated himself a little bit in this area, he's capable of relating to Yadus on the basis of truth, as opposed to satisfying emotions, he should be thankful for it. He shouldn't feel superior. And also bear in mind another thing, and that is to say that your situation is different. To a large extent, let's be honest, when you're young, and you're attracted to certain ideas, and of course you try and present it as being an attraction to truth, bear in mind that a significant part of the attraction has to do with the fact that it enables you to gain a certain feeling of superiority over others. It's not entirely bishma. You're rebelling against your parents. I mean, that helps you out too. But then you, in your own mind, you walk away as feeling that you're a superior being. All of that are things that you should think about very seriously. That's tangential. But getting back to the Chazal that we're talking about, you see, this Chazal reflects that truth. Chazal were aware. You learn a very important lesson from this. Chazal did not say, you've got to say Atovia Mekim. The fact that Chazal did not insist upon that bracha is very instructive to us. Because you could ask, well, why didn't Chazal say Atovia Mekim? That's the truth. Why was Chazal indulging their emotions? That's their emotions. That they have this unwarranted attitude towards death. It's just not true. A person should recognize that this is just as much an occasion, if not more so, for being thankful and for expressing gratitude to God. Oh, because you're uninformed, because you're a child, and you can't get over your fear of death, and because you're ignorant, basically it's ignorance. Anybody that wouldn't say a Tov Yemeitu would only be because of ignorance. So why didn't Chazal say, we're not going to tolerate this ignorance? And we're going to break them down, and we'll show them that they're wrong. Chazal backed off. That's not their job. That's something else. We're not responsible for that. That's the work of the Creator. That's to circumcise these foreskins of people's hearts is not a job that was for us to do. So what they did was they established a bracha which was in line with the capacity of the people, which was helpful to the people to be able to recite that people could do Dayan Emes. Dayan Emes is something which people can relate to on the intellectual level and on the emotional level. So they work with the people. They merely said, however, you should know that the true blessing is really Atov Yemeitu. That's something that you have to understand. But there's an important lesson in the entire way in which they approach the subject. We should follow the same example. If we're fortunate to discover a truth, and it's one which is contrary to people's emotions and so forth, you should respect the people and be very careful. Your inclination should not just be to go out there and flaunt these things in people's faces. That's certainly not a proper usage of the true ideas. That's not perfection. That's not a perfected person. A perfected person, before you can help other people to bring them closer to the truth, you've got to be pretty perfected yourself. And you've got to have gone beyond that point where the motivating factor is to demonstrate your superiority over somebody else. If you're motivated by that, then you're not going to... Then you have a serious defect to begin with, and secondly, you're not going to help others. You're just going to cause more harm. Rabbi Shimon was on there. Rabbi Shimon says, this is in the Perkeles, fourth parak, Mishnah 23. Rabbi Shimon says, Al teratas vavercha b'shas kasar. Do not seek to pacify your friend at the time of his anger. And don't try and comfort him at the time that his deceased is lying in front of him. In other words, that mesa mutlafana means at the time of death, prior to burial. And if you try to give him tanchumen, you try and comfort him, consolation, do not do so at that time. And you should not seek to talk him out of his nether at the time that he wants to make a nether. The altishtadi alaroso, and she should not seek to see him b'shas kalkaloso.
What does that want to say? To?
At the time of his degradation.
Okay.
But it makes good sense that it means when you see a person is in a state of kas, or he's in a state of anger, that's not the time to try and pacify him. He's going through an episode, and sometimes you just have to sit it out. You wait it out. Very often, you'll notice that in people. You get to learn people's habits. That they're arguing, they get extremely angry, and you're trying to answer reasonably, and you see whatever you say doesn't work. And sometimes you have to realize that anything I say is not going to help at this point. The person's in the state now where they just have to release their anger. And once they've gotten past that state, and you let them release their anger, sometimes it's a good strategy not to defend yourself. In different relationships, you have to know the situation. Let them get it out of their system. Because when they get out of their system, then their emotional state will change. Then you try and reason with them. And as far as trying to comfort a person when their deceased is right in front of them, that seems to make good sense. It's almost a cruel. Because consolation is to try and put things in perspective. Try and tell them basically that it's a bad thing and so on and so forth, but they should be able to absorb it and go on. So you're telling them to try and accept it. So there is a time when a person has to realize that this is not the end of everything, the end of life. But if you tell them that at the very moment when he's experiencing the whole anguish of the death, so it's almost cruel. Like you're negating the whole loss. How can you say it like that? A person doesn't want to hear a thing like that. They want to be given. They want to have at least an opportunity to express their anguish. They just lost a child, or whatever the case may be, and they're in a complete state of anguish. And you're telling them already. You're trying to put it in perspective. They'll go crazy. What are you telling me? It seems to be. I think most people, more or less, could achieve that recognition. What was it necessary? What was the chiddush over here? What is the deeper idea behind this? The deeper idea is, maybe it may relate to what we said, is that very often, see, why would a person do a thing like this? What would motivate a person to want to console somebody at the moment of his greatest anguish, when consolation is simply not in order? Well, why would a person seek to pacify someone at the moment when he's totally engulfed in his anger and where it's not going to have the proper effect? And as opposed to waiting, sitting back and waiting. Yeah?
Well, basically,
I think the common denominator over here is like this, is that what is motivating the person to intervene in these situations? It's not. He's not really doing so because of an objective interest in the good of the other person, but by his own personal emotion to help. That's the key. Whatever you may be going deeper at to explain why he has such an emotion. I'm not going that deep at this point. But what Chazal is saying is, that people have a natural emotion to try and help others. And that's why when they see someone in a state of anger, they want to pacify. Let's grant them that level. That they want to help somebody else. What Chazal is saying is that even when in the area of helping somebody else, you can't be operating on the basis of the emotional desire to help somebody else. If you just follow the emotional desire to help, and you don't use chachma, and you don't divest yourself, in order to help somebody else, you must have complete control of your emotional desire to help somebody else. Because what that comes from, I don't know. But if you're just following your emotional desire to help somebody else, it's not going to work. Because that's the impulse. You see a person in a state of tragedy, they've lost someone, so the impulse to help will impel you to go and try and comfort them. And that's the worst thing you could do. So in order to help somebody else, you've got to divest, you've got to at least be aware and in control of the emotional desire to help somebody else. And then you can't follow that. You can't follow what it dictates. That emotion is going to dictate a certain course. And if you follow that course, you're going to wind up doing the exact opposite. But what you must do is to really step aside. Because, see, that goes against the impulse. If I tell you that the best thing you can do for this person is to just sit there and say nothing, that you're not satisfying my impulse. My impulse is I want to help them. I want to be the one to help them. Whatever the emotion may be. If you're a person who's operating on the basis of the impulse, so then you can do harmful things. But if you're operating on the level of a real objective concern, so then you'll recognize that the best thing for me to do right now is to sit back and be quiet. And you can use your mind. You have to understand psychology, how psychology works. And when certain words are appropriate and when they're not. Go back now to Shmuel's second question, that if we're saying we've made such an extensive point that death is really not a bad thing and death is a good thing and so forth and all of that, so then what about Avelis? Avelis means mourning, which a person is obligated to engage in. So why do we have the whole institution of mourning? The key question we have to ask is mourning something which is rational for man? It's really or it's irrational, but nevertheless, since the Torah deals with the nature of maleness, the Rambam says, the Rambam's position was that the institution of sacrifice of karban is only because of human weakness. It's a concession to man's weakness, that at that time people could not have related to a system that didn't have sacrifices. So that's what he's saying, that's his position. Not everybody agrees. Now I'm asking you a similar question on your position. You've got to take a stand one way or another on Avelis. Right. Bottom line.
Well, I mean,
what, saying that there's no real basis for Avelis. If a person were on a perfected plane, there'll be no Avelis. In other words, another way of putting it, will there be Avelis in Yemos HaMashiach? That could always serve as the model then. Will there be Avelis in Yemos HaMashiach? So according to Shalom Eiferman's position, no. Is that a fair representation of your position? What it follows, of course people have emotions, but the emotions will now be in line with the truth. And that will effectuate a change in the blessing of Atov HaMeter. You know, it's a good thing. So what about Avelis? Now, isn't Avelis directly related to our attitude towards death? Isn't it pretty much the other side of the coin? So shouldn't, if we follow Shalom's insight, shouldn't it follow from that there will be no Avelis in Yemos HaMashiach? All right. Well, we're definitely assuming that people will have emotions in Yemos HaMashiach. However, the expressions of the emotion will be different due to the fact emotions are affected by one's convictions, by one's ideas, that's for sure. Right? You feel good about when something happens only because in your mind that's very important, that's the good. Or when you feel bad about something, it's because in your mind that's a terrible loss. But that's only because you assume, let's say something happens in the world, a certain event, which brings about a certain economic consequence, you feel terrible. That's only because in your framework you believe that was the good. If you had a different idea, then you would feel differently about it. Now, Yemos HaMashiach,
you will have emotions, but the emotions will be directed towards the true good. The question is, will the emotional change that comes about in the Moshe Mashiach also affect the emotion of Avelus? The answer, I believe, is as Shmuel is saying, that the institution of Avelus, we're mourning, what do most people think we're mourning because of this calamity that has befell that the deceased? That's not the case. He's not in a state of pain. It's our pain. It's our loss. The whole institution of Avelus is really halakhically under the framework of Kavod HaMeis, honor to the deceased. And a person who does not, the inability to mourn properly is considered to be a serious defect. That's called an achzar. It's called cruelty. Which means he cannot identify with somebody else. There's a lack of identification. And the idea of Avelus is a recognition of human nature, that we form emotional attachments to other people, and other people are important to us. And we respect other people. We recognize their importance in our framework. So therefore, a person that doesn't want to mourn, that's an egotist. He's negating the value that this other person had. So Avelus is a natural human reaction to the loss of something which was extremely important and precious to us. That's a natural, healthy, normal emotion. You see? So that's why essentially the chiyuv of Avelus is towards those who are close to you, who are related to you. But by extension, to any person, we mourn the loss of any decent person, any good person, because we recognize that this person had value. When a person refuses to mourn, that's an indication of a base characteristic of egotism in the person. Now that, why should that change in Yavos HaMashiach? There will be an increase in kind feelings and feelings of friendship and harmony between people, and it's a natural thing. Once you establish an emotional attachment to anything, to a person, you see, people go into mourning not just by the loss. I'll prove to you, it's nothing. It's just purely a reaction to the personal loss, even when they lose a pet, because they became very attached. And once you become attached to something, so then you go into a state of mourning. Mourning is the experience of the loss of an object which had great emotional importance to you. That's a natural, normal thing, and that's why you're supposed to go through the process of mourning. That's a necessary process. It's part of the normal makeup of a human being. And of course, Allah came along and put it into Allah's framework, so that one can obtain all of the spiritual benefits. There's a lot of spiritual benefits to be obtained from such an experience. So that's a normal human reaction, and the normal human reactions will exist in the time of Yom HaMashiach. People will have friendships, people will get married, they'll have joys, and so on and so forth. So why should I assume that they won't have mourning? Mourning makes perfect sense in terms of Yom HaMashiach. I am disagreeing, therefore, with what Shalom said, that the perfectly rational person would not mourn. Absolutely not. Because the perfectly rational person has emotions. His emotions, he has normal emotions, normal emotional reactions. Not to mourn means not to really be involved, not to be attached, not to have love, to like someone, not to love someone. What's good about that? What's rational about that? Of course, who you allow yourself to be attracted to, that's a reflection of a person's values to a certain extent, who you like, who you love, who you respect, and so forth. But that's part of the natural course of human affairs. So that's why I maintain that the two things are unrelated. Because the bracha of Atov Yametiv, there, it is an expression of our evaluation of the objective event, concerning the death of this person. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And therefore we conclude that it's certainly a good thing, not a bad thing at all. Or the phenomenon of death itself. There we are expressing our view of the phenomenon of death itself. Avelus has nothing to do with that. Avelus is a personal thing. That is our own reaction to the extent to which we are affected by the loss of another human being. And you see all of the great figures of the Torah engage in Avelus. Avram Avinu, when Sarah died. Vayakam Avram got up, lispod l'sara v'livkosa. He was maspid, eulogized, and cried. V'livkosa, he cried for, went through crying, mourning, avelos. So that I say is a completely different thing.